If your passion lies in elite British road racing and you want an inside line on the teams, riders, organisers and sponsors that make this sport such a compelling spectacle, you're in the right place. I'm Timothy John, and joining me for every episode is my co-host, the Managing Director of Brother UK, Bill Jones.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here. We're going to use this platform to talk about all the key issues surrounding the sport. With special guests, deep dives into hot topics and plenty of chat, we'll keep you informed about all things UK racing. Stay tuned.
So I'm here with Sophie Smith in a London hotel, and completely coincidentally, I came down to London yesterday to see my brother, just flown in from Sydney, and Sophie is from Melbourne, and obviously he's come into London. So I saw on Twitter that she was in a hotel in Leicester Square. I thought I knew the hotel, but it was one just over the square. And next thing you know, here we are in reception, and I thought a great opportunity to talk about Sophie's new book, which has actually come out a couple of days ago. Now, that's all about the Tour de France, and Sophie isn't here on a book tour to promote her book, I'm pleased to say, but she's actually here because she's going to the tour, and you're not going to the first few stages. You're going to go straight out to France, I think, stage four. So, Sophie, great to see you, and thanks for giving me a little bit of time this morning just to, I think, talk about the book. You know, it looks amazing. So, first things first, like everybody, how was lockdown for you, Sophie? How was lockdown in Australia?
We had, Melbourne had the world's longest lockdown, so it was long. I managed to get out, had to seek government permission to be able to leave the country last year, but I came out and did the tour last year. Got stuck, so came to the UK and waited until I could go home, but it was very challenging, I think, for everyone. I don't think humans are like designed to be in isolation for that long. It's a very challenging mentally as well as physically. Put on 10 kilos or something like
yeah,
that.
Haven't we all? Haven't we all? Yeah.
During that time, but I'm glad the world is returning to, dare I say it, normal.
Yeah.
Or some form of normal, and getting here this year was a lot easier.
I'm sure, yeah, I'm sure. And you know, a lot of that's been documented, hasn't it? But you managed to get a book done, which is amazing. So they always say everyone's got a book in them. And what I was interested to know was, firstly, did you always know you had a book in you?
Not necessarily about the tour. I was always interested in writing children's fiction, but not about the tour, no, which is weird when you think about it, because I'm coming up for tour number 10, which actually pales in comparison to most of my other colleagues. I think that was why I was actually not reluctant, but a bit anxious to write a book about the tour, because when you go to this race, it's, you know, more than 100 years old. Putting a public opinion on it out there, even though I do that every year in terms of news stories and television broadcast, was a little bit daunting, actually. And then knowing I have colleagues who have written books who have, some of them have covered the tour since before I was born. So it was challenging. It was a learning curve, as was trying to write something that's not already out there about the tour.
So how did it start then? So was it your book in your head, or were you approached by a publisher? You know, tell me about how the book firstly came about and how you decided to write about what you eventually wrote about.
I was actually approached by the publisher in October 2020, which, it's not lost on me how much of a privilege that is. You know, a lot of people write a book and put forward a manuscript, and sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't get picked up. But the head publisher, Ultimo Press, at Ultimo Press, James Kellow, he's actually British, and he called me. He was from Sydney. I've never met him face to face because of the pandemic.
Okay.
All of our correspondence was by Zoom or over the phone, as was pretty much everything in this book outside of being at the Tour de France last year. And he'd said he'd followed my work for a while. I've worked as Australian Press and British Registered Press pretty much most of my career. And he'd followed my work and he said, look, you seem really good at getting under people's skin. And I said to you before we recorded this, I still don't know if that's a compliment or an insult. But he came to me with two ideas. He was like, we'd either like to write a book on Cadel Evans's the 10th anniversary of his Tour de France win, which was last year. He's the only Australian that's won the Tour. which is really something when you think about it, and or sort of like a more behind the scenes look at the Tour de France. And I think one of my strengths has always been my contacts and trying to build strong professional rapport with the people I work with and get under their skin in a way. It gets, you know, something that again isn't already out there. Try and understand who they are as people or athletes fundamentally. I get really annoyed if I walk away from an interview. I mentioned this in Pain and Privilege. The first time I interviewed Lance Armstrong one-on-one, I walked away and got nothing from him because he can lie non-verbally. I've never met anyone like him. I was really annoyed to walk away with that. I had quotes that went on a broadcast, but it was nothing. So the second option was more up my alley, so to speak. And I presented their idea back to them. And it was a very tricky time to write a book. I think 2020 was a horrible year for everyone. But my mum was also diagnosed with cancer that year, so when they approached me, I was running on fumes. And I think when you have something like that on a personal level that happens to you, creatively, my head wasn't necessarily there either. And then to take on writing a book, I think I naively thought that 2021 might go back to normal and that you might have early season races that I could be at, because as an Australian, unless you're based abroad, you can't really get to every race in the season. You have to pick which ones to do. So I don't think I appreciated how difficult it would be during a pandemic to ask very personal, very direct questions, as I did for Pain and Privilege, and over the phone or over Zoom. They're not conversations that you know pertain to just a phone call. So they were the challenges of it, but as I said, it was a learning curve, but I got there. I published a book in a time where I was asking people to be very open and very honest, when professional sports more and more now sort of distance athletes from the media and are more rehearsed and sort of, I guess, less open. And in a pandemic where everyone was isolating or mentally beat or physically beat, it was a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Now, I must confess that we had a quick coffee at Rafa, didn't we, before we came here, and I was just asking you about your background a little bit more. And in particular, I was interested in how on earth you got started in cycling journalism. Because it naturally isn't sort of something which is a big sport in Australia, for example. So would you just quickly tell us about how you got started? Because it struck me that one of the things that you said was that a particular skill that you have is to build connections with people, and you seem to build connections very, very quickly and build your network very, very quickly in the sport of cycling after you got started. So let's talk about that quick. How did you get started? So what was the catalyst for you beginning a career in professional cycling journalism?
I fluked it, really. I grew up in Ball North, Melbourne's eastern suburbs, and finished university. Always wanted to take a gap year to the UK, just couldn't afford it. So I managed to get a cadetship at a regional newspaper called the Geelong Advertiser. Moved to Geelong, and it just so happened that Geelong got the World Championships in 2010.
Amazing.
And my sports editor, about a year out from that, said to me, I wasn't doing AFL at the time, which is godlike in Australia, and he said, you're going to do this weekly page on cycling in the lead up to and through the World Championships, which in the back of my mind I thought, yeah, okay, I'll do this for a few months and tell you I can't feel it. Because I knew nothing about the sport. Like, I used to cycle as a kid all the time, I'm the oldest of four. My dad used to take us on bike rides on the weekend to give my mum a break. But I never computed that it was a professional sport. So that, again, was a steep learning curve. And I was lucky I had a mentor at the paper, the late Simon Townley, who was a cycling fiend. And I'd go over to him and look at a result sheet and be like, this doesn't make sense. Why do they all have different times? Or, but once I got, same sort of thing about the Tour, everyone's like, what keeps you coming back to the Tour? I think cycling's the same. Once you get your head around it, it's incredibly addictive. And at the World Championships that year, I had this amazing opportunity to... It was a free-for-all for me. Like, my editor said to me, you'll either, this will be the start of something great, or you'll never have another opportunity, so like this, so make most of it. And I did. I went to every national team press conference. There were a lot of big riders out there at the Worlds that year, and that became a launching pad. I got offered jobs off the back of that and met a lot of people there who were either established stars or established road captains. I hate the word stars, established athletes or champions, or were sort of up and comers, people like Marcel Kittel, who got bronze in the under 23 time trial and went on to be the benchmark of sprinting years later. So sort of meeting those people there, and then just actively staying in touch with them, so getting their contact details and either, you know, finding out at the beginning of every season what their objectives were and keep in touch with them over the phone or throughout the year. And it's a lot of the people I met there actually are still sources now, so I was lucky in a way.
So really, I guess timing is one of the big things there. So the serendipitous that you had this World Championship and you happened to be on that newspaper and get that opportunity to follow that thread. And, you know, lucky for us, what that meant was is that started your, fundamentally, your professional career. So so back in that day, in that first year, let's say, who were the riders that were kind of on the scene that you were reporting on at that World Championship?
So Geelong, where I was based, is actually, as it turns out, Cadel Evans had a base there on the coast in the off season. Lee Howard, who's an Australian road rider and track rider, he signed with High Road, and so every summer the High Road team would come out, and then just through networks and people introducing me to other people, like Rod Ellingworth he was at British Cycling at the time, he was out doing recon. That's sort of how it started. And I think a lot of the time the tour people are, you know, they just follow, or in cycling even, they just follow Australian riders, or they just, you know, if they're Australian, I just follow British riders if they're British. Whereas I sort of, like it was open slather, I really took my editor's words literally and went to every national team press conference, interviewed everyone that I could speak English with, because I still don't speak a second language, which is bad, and stayed in touch with them. And I think that was advantageous because it gave me a real sort of idea, also working in TV and print, gave me a more well-rounded idea of the sport and what it takes to be successful in it.
So do you think your inexperience at that time was actually an advantage to some degree, because you didn't have that any convention, you just sort of went everywhere, met everybody, did whatever you can to sort of inhale what was that World Championship, but that actually in itself managed to then expose you to quite a lot of people, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was advantageous in that I didn't come from a cycling background, so I wasn't a fan of the sport before I came in, and that, so I wasn't starstruck. I've always approached these athletes as people, not, oh, you're a Tour de France stage winner or a yellow jersey champion or green jersey champion. And I think also being new, and by the time the World Championships came round, I had a deeper understanding of how the sports worked. And I wasn't afraid to ask questions. I wasn't involved in the politics of the sport at that time. I was quite young, so I just asked honest questions or put my hand up whenever, made sure I was heard and got a question across. And always was well-researched, like tried to ask something that wasn't already out there, which helped my learning experience and gave me something unique to put out there.
Yeah, I can imagine. So, you know, from those early days, sort of pulling this back to the book, who in those early days are people that you built relationships with appear in the book? So you mentioned Cadel Evans, for example, just a moment there. So, and I saw a list of some of the people actually when researching the book, and Cadel features in the book, right? So what are you bringing from the Cadel story into the book?
With the Cadel story, it was more focusing on his history at the tour, because a lot of his title attempts were almost before my time.
Yeah.
And when he won the 2011 tour, I actually wasn't there. I moved to the UK in 2012, and that was my first tour that year, literally like 2 weeks off the boat. I think with him, he's almost not taking me under his wing, but I think because, we just had an open relationship. I wasn't at the time. I knew I didn't have an agenda. I hadn't been on the road for all those years and had formed an opinion on him necessarily. So I've always had quite an open dialogue with him. And I think Cadel's one of those people where you have to understand him. Like he talks in pain and privilege about, above all else at the tour, the noise getting to him the most. So people before the pandemic, at the tour, it was like the Wild West, you know, we could be face to face with these riders and touch them, and that's what he found out of, you know, all the years it took him, almost a decade to win the tour, which is, I think, to come back again and again and again and try and do that, when you consider that Tadej Pogacar has won, what, two before his 23rd birthday. But I thought he'd say, you know, like, competing against people, as he said, that were on higher octane fuel or not having the team was said. He said not having the team was his biggest weakness, and being out hurt more than anyone else was his strength. But what he found most difficult about the race was the noise around it. And to get away from that, he said on a really bad day, he'd actually lock himself in the bathroom in a hotel and just sort of just rock from side to side and try to block it out, try to forget about it. Or read a book on Captain Cook or something like that, because that's what bothered him, and what he found was the biggest struggle.
Wow, that's incredible, isn't it? Because you'd never hear that insight in a TV interview, would you? You wouldn't say something, you probably wouldn't be asked that question, nor would he have a platform, because it would either be managed by the press people, one would assume, to sort of go, that's off message, that's not what we want to talk about. What we want to talk about is the team and our objectives and all these sorts of things. So do you think that's an example of some of the stories, effectively, that you're bringing out inside the book?
Yeah, exactly. I've tried to, we were talking about it before, again, it's timing. So I only had roughly a year to interview for this and write something was coherent, working with the publisher. So it was that interview I actually did with Cadell over the phone at the tour last year, on his 10th anniversary. A lot of them I did it over the phone in between races. So I think when you get to the tour, the athletes are really drilled. I have this story with Primoz Roglic, where the first time I interviewed him was at the tour, and like everyone just thought he was really difficult because he was just like really focused and not rude, but very sort of not necessarily forthcoming with answers.
Yeah.
But I spoke to him. I went to the Tour of Britain that year and spoke to him there, and he was a lot more relaxed and sort of less drilled, less robotic. And I think sometimes they're like that, either because they have an agenda, like, or the team has a storyline, or they're just in that sort of race mode where something Chris Froome says, like when he competes at the Tour, it's like he's got blinkers on and he just blocks everything else out apart from winning a race at all costs, because he's worked that hard for it to be there. That he's not going to let anyone else take that away from him.
Yeah, which must be difficult for a journalist as well, because I'm guessing during that period that the riders know they have to do press conferences. They probably know that the usual questions are going to come up, and it's very much, it's just ticking the box, get it done, get me out of here, let me get go back to my room, start my recovery, etc. So for you to gain these deeper stories must have been quite difficult. So to some degree, did the pandemic help that? Because the riders were a bit more accessible, they probably weren't racing quite as much. Many on the balconies on turbo trainers in, you know, Monaco and Monte Carlo, taking selfies. So do you think that was an advantage for you when writing the book?
Yes and no. So it made them, I guess, I was able to do that. They were at home. They weren't necessarily doing anything else. But you speak to most sports psychologists and they say time management is a thing with cyclists, they're not very good at it. So in some ways, yes, it was, when you're doing a lot of things over the phone, but also doing it over the phone when you're asking them questions that sort of go beyond the glamorous veneer of the tour can be quite difficult, like asking people about, you know, fat shaming and eating disorders or mental health over the phone, when typically in society, let alone sport, we don't openly discuss those. Was challenging. And also at the tour last year, with the restrictions that the race organizer ASO put in place to minimize the spread of COVID, that was difficult because you couldn't be. I always say, like, I start to feel irresponsible if I'm covering the tour from home, because by the second week, the real stories you get from being on the ground, you get from being at races and they're in the team's paddock and talking to people, and sometimes just actually saying, how's your day, not interviewing someone face to face, you get a lot more from them than, because they'll be honest about, oh, today's awful, today I'm over this, whatever. Whereas the restrictions that were put in place last year physically separated us from the riders and the team officials, and you had to sort of yell over a barrier or know them so that they would stop. Yelling out to them was also, there's a journalist from the Telegraph that said it was really degrading, which, given pre-pandemic, we'd literally run after adults, fully grown adults running after each other. You're like, it's probably on par. But that, again, was where that professional rapport that I've always focused on and tried to build came in handy, because they would come over to you or they would stop. Whereas if they didn't know you, I think the tourist days like this for the new generation of journalists coming through, I think that will be a challenge for them. Like, it's, you'd have to find different ways to be able to communicate with them.
Do you find riders now are far more protected by their press officers, and news is much more micromanaged effectively? So maybe having over 10 years worth of black book content is probably very advantageous for you, because you've built a good rapport, built good relationships, all of these things. So to some degree you can text or message these riders directly. Whereas I'm guessing nowadays, if there was a new journalist starting, it would be far more difficult, because they would be constantly being filtered by a press officer. So would you think you could have achieved the same outcomes starting in 2022 in this professional sport?
It'd be a lot different. So I think when I started, particularly early season races, press officers were few and far between. There were probably only a handful of big teams that had them. So you could just say to a rider, what's your number or what's your email? I'm going to get in touch. And to some extent, I still do that with some of my sources. But also now, because every team basically has a press officer as a courtesy, I do, even though I know I can speak to that person directly,
okay, yeah.
I do say, heads up, I'm doing this. So again, it gets, you know, I always felt back in the day that cutting out the middleman, being the press officer, so to speak, was easier and more direct. But I think the system now, you could be disrespectful to do that. And sometimes, you know, they are like, a good press officer is a good press officer.
Yeah,
like, they can help you communicate and give you a heads up as to something that might be happening behind the scenes. But it'd be, it's another different layer.
So you've got the best of both worlds, really. So you know how to sort of play the game, in inverted commas, and know the system, but equally you have that ability to perhaps go directly to somebody because of that long relationship that you built up. And what fascinated me when we were talking Rafa was that you said your dad was a federal agent in Australia, and I thought, well, no wonder she's a journalist, and no wonder she's really good at interviewing people, because your dad as a federal agent probably listened a lot and knew what he had to do to get things out of people in his professional career.
Yeah.
He's
probably a better interviewer than I was. He sort of had a more softly approach, whereas mine sort of a bit more direct. Sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, but yeah.
So in the book, Sophie, what do you think are some of the chapters which kind of you're most proud of, or you think really bring a deeper insight to this sport that people may not have seen or heard before? So could you just walk us through a couple of chapters that you think maybe the audience listening today might really learn something new about?
It's funny, this happens to me with stories. I'll write a chapter that I'm really under the pump and just sort of had to get it out, and the publisher loved those stories, and the ones I labored over for ages not so much. But there are things that in the book that even I learned something from. So the chapter called Hunger Pains, I focus on mental health and eating disorders in the peloton, because weight is a huge performance gain still in pro cycling, and it was something that's always obvious. Like, if you go to the tour every year, and these men are so lean. Like, you look at some of them and they've got biceps that are the size of my wrist. You know, I got a line in there where I once interviewed Chris Froome, and I'd said to him, you look, even in January, you look super lean. And he was like, oh no, I've got to lose a few kilos. Like, it's the opposite to society, where men want to be big and bulky. But Hunger Pains, I spoke to riders about, what is that fine line between being lean enough to, you know, tackle these mountains that are thousands of meters above the clouds or above sea level, and being, having an eating sort of being, being under, clinically underweight. Because a lot of them, like, I know Froome said, he's, and it's in Pain and Privilege, his ideal race weight, and not many of them reveal this, like, it's a real thing. They sort of, they're constantly every season talking about, you know, I need to lose a kilo or 2 kilos or whatever, but none of them will, very few of them will actually say, this is my race weight. And Chris Froome at the time, when I asked him, he was 67 kilos, and I was like, that was 3 kilos more than what I weighed at the time.
Yeah,
I'm a 5'10" female, and he's 6 foot something.
He's grown, a grown man.
Male.
Yeah.
But that chapter was, I learned something in there, because I also spoke to, it was sort of quite personal experiences talking to riders about their relationship with food, which was sometimes quite unhealthy.
Yeah.
And then speaking to team staff, like the head nutritionist at Jumbo Visma, who, and I didn't know any of this, like the Jumbo Visma have a food app, which tells riders, they log into it every day and it tells them exactly what they need to eat down to the gram every single day at the tour, in the lead up to the tour. I was comparing that with previous generations that didn't have that. I spoke to the James Forsyth, who's the head chef at Ineos Grenadiers, and he is the head chef of the tour, it's only him. And he was talking about, A, for him personally, the insane pressure of that when you've got someone, a team as big and successful as Ineos Grenadiers. He's like, if I get something wrong, if the food's not fresh or not tasty enough or appetizing enough, I don't know how tasty. That was one of the challenges for him, is to make it appetizing enough that they eat it. Then that falls on him, because as it turns out, the Jumbo Visma nutritionist was saying that if a rider's not sick or injured at the tour and they have a bad day, he put that down entirely to what they haven't eaten. He's like, you can win or lose a Tour de France purely based on diet. And that sort of behind the scenes focus is not something I knew of. I knew they obviously have to stay lean and eat not a lot or certain foods, but how that all sort of came together and how fine it is was something new to me. And also the chapter, I've forgotten the name of it now, the Alpha from Africa, which was sort of focused on the yellow jersey winners and Chris Froome specifically and his rise to being a, you know, what is he, four-time Tour de France champion, and contrasting that with a chapter called Master and Apprentice, which is on Richie Porte, apologies, and his rise, and how he and Chris went from being very close friends, very close teammates, who Richie sacrificed for, to being rivals, and how that worked out. And, you know, Froome was honest in saying he's cutthroat when he gets on the bike. It's nothing stands in his way, which Port struggled with. With that, you know, that change in relationship was tough for him, and also just, you know, the pressure that's put on title contenders every year was something that, and again, this was really interesting, that the noise that's around them, the pressure of the team not being supported, and sometimes a lot of them talked about even just being supported off the bike, like having a teammate that would reassure them, as much as, you know, being on the bike and having someone that was, you know, able to guide them in the right way. That was a big one, you know, again, in terms of that mental look and how riders, you know, for me, like, mentality is a huge part of it as well, as much as physical ability. You know, Richie in Master and Apprentice talks about when he was a title contender, that pressure of being a title contender as opposed to a super domestique, you know, that was something that he really struggled with. And that, you know, it was a year he crashed out, and he just says, he was real, I appreciated how honest he was, he just says it felt like he was running away from a fight. Like, he was like, oh, you know, the crashing out was not a relief, but almost a relief. So there are a few that I learned something from.
That's fascinating. I'm sitting here because that sort of was resonating with me a little bit there, because I was in a fortunate position of going from a number two to number one in the company. And when I went to number one, what I realised was everything changed. And actually, there's only so many people that can go from a number two to a number one. And some people are probably sometimes better left as number twos and can be world-class number twos. But to cross the bridge to be that number one, I think only fewer people can make that selection. So I'm sort of sitting here with that reverberating in mind, thinking, that reminds me a bit of my story there.
Yeah.
I just want to sort of track back for a moment, because this whole issue of weight management, I guess, in professional cycling, that it's one of probably the fewest sports where men greet each other and say, oh, you look lean and we think that's great, rather than you look big or you look in good shape. You know, it's about that looking skinny. But in reality, you're right, that I didn't know that all of this absolute micromanagement was going on. But I'm sure there's other riders who completely reject that and go, I don't want that, I just want to eat to be, you know, I want to eat. I think Robbie McEwen, you recently wrote, there was an article, take an excerpt from the book in the Telegraph in the last few days, where sort of Robbie McEwen was almost the opposite of that, and he was like, nah, forget all that. I just want to eat 7 meals a day, 3 big ones or 4 small ones, and I'm just going to eat.
Yeah.
And it didn't stop him performing, did it?
No, that's the thing. I asked him about the food app, and he just said it would have done his head in, you know. He's, for him, being able to, and it was a different era, and obviously his was another thing. One of the other chapters I talk about is the dynamics of a team and the tour. You know, there are some stages that Matthew Haven says he'd come up to a mountain stage and he was just riddled with fear almost, because he was like, that might have been the day for his teammate. And for someone like him, or a sprinter like Robbie McEwen, who talks about surviving mountain stages, he compares it to waterboarding. But you know, it was interesting. He said his relationship with food was a lot healthier, because he was like, if I went back to my room and wanted a chocolate, I'd have a chocolate.
Yeah.
And in his mind, that made him happy. He didn't have this extra stress of, I can have that, or I can't have that, or I shouldn't have that, or I should have that. And that worked for him. He just had a craving within reason. You know, he wanted some fresh fish, or he wanted a chocolate bar.
Yeah.
And he puts that down to his physiology as well. He just said he had veins upon veins, and physiology really came down to it. Some people can naturally do that. Some people can't. But the other element of it, and you know, a happy cyclist is generally a good cyclist.
So he wouldn't be reaching like I do for a whole bag of Haribo Star Mix.
We might. Some of them do that. If you look straight after a stage, Peter Sagan's one for it. Like at the end of a stage, it's a really hot day. He has the little packets. He will literally have like handfuls of it and just shove it in his mouth until his cheeks almost burst. So there are exceptions, which I didn't cover in the book, but yeah, I think immediately after a stage the rules are slightly different. There's a Coke can or a Haribo.
Sophie, who will this book appeal to? So when you're writing it, who did you have in your mind for this? Is it for the hardcore cycling fan? Is it for the generalist? Is it for a Tour de France fan? So sort of in your mind when you were talking about the book with the publisher, who did you have as your audience?
It was both, actually. And that was tricky as well, because you wanted something that, you know, the Tour de France is obviously a massive event. I wanted to cater for the cycling aficionado who doesn't need, you know, an explainer as to what the peloton is. But for the publisher and for me, it was also important to be able to bring in that mainstream audience, because there is a mainstream audience that watches the tour every year, maybe just for the scenery, but but they do. So I open with an introduction that sort of gives an explanation, so that when you read the chapters, you know, there are some terms that are everyday for cycling fans but might not be. So I've tried to cater for both and sort of reveal the other sort of more tarnished side of the coin with the tour and with cycling, because a lot of the times, especially with the tour, it's, you know, glamorized and celebrated. The athletes are gladiators who have suffered these insane crashes and, you know, soldier on, and you know, the race is spectacular and there's 12th century chateaus on the coverage, where the reality is, like, you know, the Ibis is a good is a 5-star option when you're in the middle of regional France. Or I've stayed in a nunnery before, I've stayed at converted mental asylum, I think. So there's that option of it, but yeah, also trying to get into that other side that you don't see, and also not even just with the winners, with people that you might not have heard of but have like incredible stories. Jens de Boucher, who's a Belgian rider who one year gave up his own chances at the race to help his teammate, you know, make the time cut, when his teammate and everyone else around him had said, no, he's done. It was difficult because there's an infinite number of stories that come from the tour.
Yeah, of course.
And a lot of them are so compelling. But it was, yeah, trying to cater for both audiences, trying to meet my brief, get under the skin of riders, show a different side of the tour. So I hope both.
Oh, that's fantastic. And yeah, finally, how long did it take you to write?
Yeah, it was... I got approached in October 2020, and my deadline was October 2021, which I pushed slightly. So about a year, which I know to a lot of accomplished authors is, you know, can be sometimes, that's a dream.
Yeah.
But the trouble with the tour is the narrative changes every year. So a lot of the book I sort of wrote in the first half of 2021, thinking that, you know, 2021? Yeah. you know, after Sam, Bennett was the benchmark in sprinting, and a lot of it sort of, I'd wanted to make it not timely either, so it is something that people can come back to and read in future years. But there are a few chapters on the green jersey or sprinters where I'd sort of covered that, and of course the 2021 tour happened and everything changed. As an example, Sam Bennett wasn't selected, Mark Cavendish made this insane career comeback and won four stages. So there was some of it that was planned, and then after the 2021 tour, navigating back to Australia and quarantining in something that felt like jail, a lot of it I had to almost rewrite, and very, 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 very quickly. So a year. And then a month.
And before we wrap up, obviously you've come over to cover this tour, the 2022 edition of the Tour de France. Yeah. And what I thought was fascinating, again, chatting before we started recording, was that you sort of cover your own costs for this. So effectively, you're a freelancer. Mm-hmm. So that means you pay for your flights, you've got to organise all your own hotels, your transfers, so everything, even your bar bills.
Yeah. They can add up as a journalist.
Which I'm sure, yeah. I'm sure bar bills is an important part of getting great stories and getting great content. So how does your business model work for that then? So you've got all this outlay, so you then generate your content, and then you're trying to syndicate that out effectively to whoever will buy it fundamentally.
Exactly. It's a hustle every year.
It's a hustle, right.
It's a hustle every year. Right. Sometimes you're fortunate enough where you have a client who will cover your expenses. And sometimes that is something that you have to recoup yourself. So it's almost like a year's worth of planning, or 6 months worth of planning. I was lucky this year in that I'm traveling with some journalists from Cycling Weekly who did the hotel itinerary for me, but it's a massive undertaking financially and logistically. You know, it's a 5,500 kilometre round trip in a car, so you have to sort of like the people you're traveling with, or accept that you're going to fall out at least once.
That's right.
I think that's the same for everyone.
Yeah,
because accumulative fatigue at the tour is huge. And I say this in pain and privilege, it's amazing at the start of the race, and every day, I almost call it a face diary, where people just start to physically age from all the transfers and from just how intense the racing is, or the, you know, reporting around the racing is. So hustle, hard work.
Yeah. Yeah. I can really understand that. We first met in 2018 when James Golden and I did the Tour of Britain One Day Ahead, and that was obviously only 8 days, but I got a small glimpse then into what that really means, because you spend a day on the bike and then have to do this enormous transfer of sometimes 150 miles or something like that. So you then get to the hotel and you're knackered, and then the mechanics are off doing their bit, and you've then go, oh, I've got to eat, and I feel tired, and then suddenly, you know, I began to realise the difference between tiredness and fatigue.
Yeah.
That build up, it just catches you up, doesn't it? It really does build up over those days.
Yeah.
And it probably took me, I think, a few weeks to get over that once we'd done it. It was a few weeks before I finally felt like I'd got rid of that relentless tiredness, not just from the energy you expend of being on the bike, but actually it was everything, actually, when you bring the aggregation of it all together.
Exactly,
the energy output that you have to put out as a human being to do that. So over 21 days of racing and 24 days of, I think this year, of the entire tour, that's a hell of an undertaking, isn't it? It's a hell of an undertaking. So how do you keep going through all of that?
Coffee and adrenaline. No, I think for me, it's sort of, at least at the end of a day, I have my own hotel room to go back to. I think sometimes I just start to skip breakfast and we'll take a coffee cup. Admittedly, sometimes swipe one from a hotel and just scull it in the car on the way there. But for the riders especially, like, even just outside the physical feat of competing on the road every day and staying concentrated and you know, vigilant, is you just don't get a let up from other people. And again, this is something that I didn't know before writing this book, or I did, but I've never explored it. You know, the riders, because of logistically what the tour is like, have twin share accommodation. And some of them are used to that. Geraint Thomas used to say that his rooms he'd like share a room with Ian Stannard more than he would his own wife. And he was used to that. He didn't like being on his own. But the writers have a, you know, there's a chapter I do on Swan Years, who a lot of the writers described as like quasi-therapists.
Yeah.
Because they don't get any time alone. They have breakfast together. They're on the team bus together. They race together. They're on the team bus again together. They have dinner together, and then they share a room. And the 45-minute window that they have with a soigneur to get a massage is the only time they can either just say nothing and not have anyone come to them, or where they can just let out and, you know, criticize their teammate or just blow off some steam. So I think that as well, like, that would kill me, not just having some alone time to decompress during the race. But also, you know, I think you kind of just start to, I always say you can sort of feel the heartbeat or feel the pulse of the tour. I used to have an editor at Cycling Week who wouldn't let us do more than 5 days on, 5 days off. And I hated it because you'd come in and it takes a couple of days to get into the rhythm and for the nerves to settle down for everyone, I think. And then you'd leave again. And that's when you started to notice how like people would physically age when you came in and out. But I mean, when you're in it, you don't see that as much, and you're sort of talking pigeon English at the end. But yeah, it's a huge undertaking, particularly when you don't get, you know, you can't, as you know, in cycling, if you have a bad day, you can't go home and see the family and, you know, be substituted out. It's, if you don't start and finish a stage, you're out. So, yeah, there are real personal and professional challenges to it.
Amazing. Well, I mean, Sophie, I literally could sit here talking all day to you. It's fascinating because you've got this sort of layer of information, I guess, that many of us who watch the sport would love to understand better. But at least what we now have is your book.
Yeah.
And this is the book plug time, where I quickly tell the audience. So the book, Pain or Privilege, Inside the Tour, Le Tour, is out now, isn't it? It came out a couple of days ago.
It is,
It's available everywhere, as far as I can see. It's on Kindle, it's on Amazon, it's in all good bookstores and all that good stuff. And it's under a tenner, which I think is amazing.
It's good,
Yeah, it's under a tenner. So, yes, great value for money. I think it's actually $8.99 on Amazon, something like that, and a bit less for the Kindle edition. So that sounds to me like an incredibly well-priced book, which should hopefully sell really well. And one thing I have realised, I guess, because I know a few people that have written books, is often you don't write books because you're going to make a fortune out of them. There isn't actually a huge amount of money for you as the writer in book writing.
It's my first book, but that is what I've been told.
You're not going to make your first million from your first book, but you know, it's great to see that book out there, and at least now you understand what it takes to write a book. We are able to sort of tap into those 10 years worth of networks and knowledge and people that you've developed in your professional career as a journalist. And you know, I'm personally really looking forward to reading it, because I love to find out those deeper insights. You know, we all just get presented with information, don't we, when it's around the talks, all very managed, all very staged. But actually, I think in life, and particularly post-pandemic, people want deeper stories. People want to understand that purpose. Who are these people as people? And I think from what I've heard today, that really the book is all about that.
Yeah.
Is getting under the bonnet properly. Under the bonnet properly of understanding the tour through your eyes.
Taking you through the stages. Which it is like, it's, I was actually quite anxious when the book came out. It had nothing to do with money. It was more sort of like, felt like your baby was going out into the world. And because these writers have been so open and honest with me, I almost added another layer to the anxiety, because it was, you know, you're putting out raw accounts. Thank you. I'm hoping it's well received.
Well, I'm sure it will be. So everybody, please rush out, buy the book. Let's make it Amazon number one bestseller as quickly as we can. And hopefully drive Sophie onto her second book and the multi-million pound book offers that will come off the back of that. So Sophie, thank you so much for giving me your time this morning. Honestly, absolutely fascinating. And I'm sure all the listeners who've heard you speak today will be enthralled that you're here. Also, one thing I want to mention was, if you want to keep track of you, on Twitter at SophieSmith86. So please follow Sophie on Twitter, and hopefully you'll be posting from the race, I guess, will you?
Always, yeah. Every day.
You'll be posting from the race, so you can keep an inside track on what Sophie's up to day by day, and perhaps we can see how tired you begin to look by day 9, 10 yeah. or 15. That'd be very funny. So Sophie, have a great tour.
Thank you so much.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, please hit subscribe.